Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 30th of June already. Our guest this hour, Jonathan Rauch, has written a provocative, lengthy, interesting, informative piece in The Atlantic, which has this title, How American Politics Went Insane. It happened gradually, and until the U.S. figures out how to treat the problem, it will only get worse. Jonathan is a contributing editor at National Journal and The Atlantic. He wrote the cover story, which I just gave you the title of. He's also the author of quite a few books and articles on public policy, culture, and economics. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and the article has you, alas, alas, imagine the year 2020. That's how it starts. The campaign is underway to succeed the president who's retiring after a single wretched term. Voters are angrier than ever at politicians, at compromisers, at the establishment. Congress and the White House seem incapable of working together on anything, even when their interests align. It's what he thinks may happen, and maybe it will happen. Who knows? Jonathan outlines where we are politically and why American politics are pretty insane at this point in time, and we're happy to have him on the show. We'll eventually be welcoming phone calls. I would think this is a subject that you will want to comment on. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your messages there, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Jonathan, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. Nice to have you here. Well, you start the article with this horrendous 2020 vision. Oh, my gosh. But, you know, things are so weird right now, it doesn't seem entirely unlikely.
Well, yes. Everything in my 2020 vision was actually just a fairly modest straight line extrapolation of where we are right now, a system on Capitol Hill that can't keep the government open, Congress not being able to fill the Supreme Court not being able to decide key cases, and a completely chaotic presidential race with Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty as the leader on the Republican side, and the establishment such as there is in complete total meltdown. That's really not that different from right now.
No, it sure isn't. I mean, it really isn't. And you go through this, the article is wonderful because it looks at, it goes way back to the founders of the country and what they were looking at and where their shortcomings were and how we have tried to fix that. But let's talk about the current dysfunction before we go to the past. There is a possibility, you indicate, which I had forgotten about, that we could see another government shutdown perhaps this fall, right before the election.
Yeah, sure. One of the things that Speaker Ryan prided himself on trying to do was restoring some regular order and some regularity to the budget process. And he wasn't Speaker 3 months or 4 months before his own conservatives said, well, we don't like the deal that Speaker Boehner made on his way out the door. We're revoking it. So it's going to be up to them, not up to Speaker Ryan or the majority on Capitol Hill, about whether to keep the government open.
Mm-hmm. You write, Jonathan, the very term party leader has become an anachronism. There is no longer any such thing as a party leader. Why isn't there, and when do we lose party leaders?
Well, boy, thereby hangs a tale. I noticed you used the word long in introducing my article.
I read it all. It's good. It's a good long article.
no one said it should be longer, but then I'm paid by the word. So the reason it's long is it tries to go through that process. But here's the headline version. For the last 40 to 50 years, Americans have been making war on our own political class. We decided that political professionals and insiders and parties, hacks and machines, that all of these things were corrupt and untransparent and undemocratic and unnecessary. So we passed reform after reform to strip them of power, only to discover, here we are in 2016, that there was a reason that those people and structures were there, which is they brought order to politics. They made it possible for leaders to lead by incentivizing followers to follow. That is, you know, suppose you got to keep the government open, but it's a tough vote because conservatives back in your district won't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what would happen when these systems worked is the congressional leaders would say, tell you what, we'll put you on the fast track for that next promotion in Congress. Or how about that airport renovation in your district? We can do that for you. So they'd give them pork. Or campaign money. We'll throw another $2 million into your campaign because we got some soft money running around here. Or best of all, what they could do is they couldn't control who was running for office, but they could say, we'll make it a lot easier for you to get reelected. We'll use our clout to discourage other people from running. We'll swing support in the district behind you. They were able to use all these tools to get followers to follow. Well, we dismantled most of that stuff, weakened it, dismantled it. We did this to ourselves as a country. The problem is that, well, you know, some of that stuff may not have looked really appealing when you held it up to the ethical microscope. It turns out that when you don't have any of those incentives to get people to team play, they don't team play, and you get chaos.
And yet you talk about, and you just did, those reforms being well-meaning political reforms. Isn't the idea of democracy to have it as open and transparent as possible? Isn't that the best way to go?
Well, you might take that up with Mr. Madison, who held the Constitutional Convention behind closed doors. There was a reason for that. The founders did not envision a system that was maximally democratic and maximally participatory. They wanted a balanced system. They wanted a representative system. They wanted time for reflection. They wanted private spaces where candid negotiations could go on and people could say, look, I'd really like to do more, but I can't right now. But maybe if you give me this, I can do that. So, no, the answer is not to have total transparency like a fishbowl all the time. The answer is not to have everything decided directly by voters all the time, because that actually means they get decided by the special interests that will show up at the polls and manipulate the voting. So what we need is a mixed system, and that's what we've forgotten. We forgot the mixed part.
Mm-hmm. You remind us, and I wonder how many Americans are even aware of this now, that one chamber, only one chamber was directly elected then, that the Senate was decided by state legislatures. Why, and was there something perhaps beneficial about that system that we ought to reconsider?
Well, I don't think we're going back to a non-elected Senate. But here's what I try to get people focused on in the article, Kathleen. It's not just the formal stuff, you know, who elects the Senate in the Constitution or the Electoral College, these things that are written down in the Constitution. We also have an unwritten Constitution, an informal Constitution of processes and systems built up over the course of the last two centuries that do the organizing within the Constitution, inside politics. They're called parties. They're called money raisers, bundlers, insiders, professionals, hacks, machines, all of these things, these organizations in politics. It took many decades to get all that stuff working so that people could work together in politics. It turns out that it's fairly resilient stuff, but if you spend 40 years saying everything the insiders are doing is corrupt and rotten, well, you're going to gravely wound your ability to organize yourself. That's why I call the theme of the article is chaos syndrome. It's long-term, it's chronic, and it's a decline in the political and governmental system to be able to organize itself to take action.
Is it related? Is chaos disorder related to this incredible ideological polarization we have right now?
Yeah, I think they feed each other, unfortunately. Polarization is a problem in its own right, especially I think it's more severe on the right and in the Republican Party. The Democrats, as we see with Mr. Sanders, are doing their best to catch up. But one of the reasons we're polarized is that it's become much harder to compromise. And one of the reasons it's become much harder to compromise successfully is that we have opened the negotiations that used to be held behind closed doors. We have made it much harder for a party leader to incentivize people to make a compromise that, you know, might expose them to a primary challenge. It's a great moment. I'll never forget when former Speaker John Boehner, remember him? Remember when he was on the Leno show? The government had shut down.
Yes.
No one wanted that to happen except, you know, a few protesting members of Congress on the right and Ted Cruz. he was asked why he let that happen. And he said very poignantly, a leader without followers is just a man taking a walk. Mm. So what we got up there now are 535 people taking a walk. And what we got in the presidential race are candidates who are self-recruited and run independently of the system or anyone else, can do and say pretty much whatever they want to. What we lose here is the accountability that allowed for team play and organization in the system.
And you also remind us of incredibly significant pieces of legislation that were, you point to LBJ's civil rights bill and how that was done with consideration of other senators in mind, and what can I do for you that will help you, that will help me pass the piece of legislation that I want to pass. It's hard to imagine a bill like that, so significant, getting passed today.
Well, you know, there's some good news. They just managed to do a Puerto Rico bailout, and they got it in 2 days under the deadline. So I try to be not totally discouraging. There's still a lot of people in politics who want to figure out ways to work together and solve problems and compromise. We're just making it harder than we actually need to.
Well, let's concentrate on the two people who have been given a lot of attention this go-around, and that's Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. How did chaos create candidates, particularly like Donald Trump? But you also mentioned Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I have this phrase I use in the article to be a little bit provocative, but political sociopath. A political sociopath is not a crazy person on the street. I mean something specific. It's a politician who doesn't care what other politicians think about him and doesn't need to care. Someone who's just completely unmoored, can do whatever he wants to, can be as disruptive as he wants to. It's very striking that in the 2016 presidential race, of the final four, not counting John Kasich because, you know, he only won one primary, of the final four candidates, three are people I would define as political sociopaths: Cruz, Sanders, and Trump. They all had business models that allowed themselves to be accountable only to themselves, say and do whatever they wanted to. Only one, Hillary Clinton, was playing by the old rules, where you try to raise money for the party and for other candidates, and you try to have networks and coattails, and you try to reward loyalty. You try to have debts, and you try to incur debts from other people. If a political sociopath gets elected, someone like a Trump or a Sanders, it's very unlikely that he could govern because no one would owe him anything and he wouldn't owe them anything. And the first day in office, he'd say, all right, let's do this. And they'd say, why? So campaigning and governing go together, Kathleen. And you've got to be able to encourage team play on both fronts. And that's what's become difficult. I like to say that politics is inherently a team sport, and we're playing it like second-grade soccer, where you remember second-grade soccer, you'd all just run out on the field and mob the ball, try to get it for yourself and try to score a goal. That's where we are, and it ain't working too well.
Mm. So what kind of provisions do we need to hold politicians together, to make them accountable to each other?
Well, there's two kinds of things. One are mechanical things, and they are actually not that difficult to do. With a whole lot of rules changes and legal changes over since the 1970s, we've really rigged the system, believe it or not, against the insiders. We've made it much harder, for example, for parties to raise money and coordinate their strategies with their candidates than for outside groups that are totally unaccountable to raise money and dump it in politics. We can reverse a lot of those provisions. It's a small but important thing. We should reinstate earmarks. We should give insiders more say, not less say, in who gets nominated. We should rethink some of the transparency rules that make it so hard to find private spaces to negotiate, and some of the money rules that make it so hard to raise money for insiders, professionals, parties. Above all, however, we need to strengthen parties. We've got one major political party, the Republicans, in a state of total meltdown and chaos right now. Democrats are not as bad off, but they're not structurally immune either. So that's the second, the really hard thing we have to do, Kathleen. It's not the mechanical stuff. It's the mental stuff. We've spent the last two generations as Americans convincing ourselves that everything that professional politicians do is corrupt and evil and unnecessary. And we're going to have to start thinking, you know, maybe our grandparents were not all crooks and morons. Maybe they understood some things about political organization, and maybe we could remember Americans were happier when the system worked a little better. And let's call off the war on professional politics and politicians.
Mm. Oh, you're going to get phone calls on this one, Jonathan. We'll take
yeah, I'm afraid
moment.
I might.
Yeah, you will. The other analysis that we've been getting from a lot of people, particularly this year, is that American voters have found that parties are irrelevant, that somehow both parties missed one of the major themes, and that's people feeling pretty hurt. They're not doing very well financially. They never recovered from the recession. They're working three jobs to make a living to get by. Something, and so the parties themselves, because they haven't addressed major issues, have made themselves open to insurgents and have made themselves somewhat irrelevant because they're not addressing Americans' concerns.
There's a process, Kathleen, that goes back to the days of Andrew Jackson in America, if not before. And it's an important part of the political process. And it's when people who don't feel like they're getting heard or represented swarm into the system, come in from outside and disrupt it. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad thing. That's a crucial part of our political cycle. It's what Andrew Jackson has happened again and again. That's how we correct the system when it is not being responsive to an important part of the political scene. But here's the important thing. You have to be able to govern through a disruption. You've still got to be able to get to win an election for your party, to organize an election, and then to govern after the election. You've got to be able to keep the bills moving through the committees, you know, the 13 appropriations bills, the debt limit bill. You've got to do something about spending when it gets out of control. You've got to keep Puerto Rico from going bankrupt. The trouble we have now is that when you get a system that gets as disorganized and chaotic as what we have right now, you get much more vulnerable to disruption, not just bringing new ideas and people into politics, but paralyzing the whole system. And that's a different kind of problem, and that's the problem we're facing now, a kind of systemic paralysis and breakdown.
We go to phone calls for you, and we'll start taking them momentarily. Our guest this hour is the author of the very informative, important piece. It's the cover story of the Atlantic July-August issue, How American Politics Went Insane. Jonathan Rauch is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open if you'd like to get one of those right now. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter, @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls, and let's start with Jerry in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to ask a guest if this might be solved. I think there's a tremendous desire on the part of the electorate to be more involved, but in order to achieve what you're suggesting, what would be the feasibility of allowing or promoting to have more than two parties?
Well, that comes up a lot, and there are a few things I'd say about that which aren't really very encouraging. One is that's very unlikely to happen. Second is, with the rules that we've got right now, why would someone think a third party would be any more functional than the other two? It would be subject to all the same forces that are leading to chaos. I mean, right now, it's very hard for parties to even select their own nominees. Donald Trump is not a Republican in any meaningful sense, yet he's heading the Republican ticket. Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat in any meaningful sense, yet he's second in number two in the Democratic campaign for president. So the third party would have the same problems as the first two. So where I come down is, let's focus on fixing the two we got. Let's not be too impractical here.
Yeah, I was just thinking that we've got parties that seem to go to the extremes, and we've got this vacuum in the middle, and maybe more people would go to the middle.
I think we do have a vacuum in the middle, but I don't think a third party is going to help with that. See, here's the problem, which political scientists have written and talked about for years. A lot of people just are really busy, and they don't have the time and the bandwidth to spend a lot of time on politics. They want less politics in their lives, not more. So the people who tend to be more active in something like a primary election or a party, a new party especially, are going to people with either a lot of time on their hands, in other words, kooks, or people with very, very strong and immoderate ideas, in other words, extremists who care about one issue, or, most of all, people with a vested interest in getting something through, special interests. So it turns out that participation does not necessarily improve representation. And the way we've historically dealt with that, with actually a lot of success until pretty recently, is you try to have party apparatuses that try to keep the moderates in mind so that when they select candidates, they'll think not just about does this appeal to the party base for the primary, but can this person win a general election? If this person does win the general election, will they be a team player so that we can count on them as a vote when we need a tough vote so we can govern? So that's what parties, when you let them do it, are historically good at. And I would argue, and there's good political science supporting this, that by weakening the parties, we have weakened the forces that give moderates effective voice inside the system.
Can you give us a little bit of a historical analysis here? You talk about Barry Goldwater and George McGovern being more extreme members of their respective parties, and they rose to the nomination and failed pretty miserably. Why did they come to the forefront, and are there others that we should pay attention to who did the same, who were extreme candidates? What it was historically that allowed this to happen instead of moving toward the center?
Well, different things in the two cases. Goldwater was the product of a civil war in the Republican Party, which is not all that different in some ways than the one that's going on right now. There were two wings, a moderate wing, which no longer exists, and that was headed by Nelson Rockefeller, and a conservative wing, which was Goldwater. And Goldwater managed to pull ahead in the primaries and thereby nailed down the nomination, to the horror of party regulars who said, this guy's going to lose, which he did spectacularly.
Mm-hmm.
He turned out to be very important in the long run. I'm in Arizona, and I have a lot of respect for Barry Goldwater for a lot of reasons. And in fact, he turned into an example of how someone can lose but still be influential in the party. Goldwater was, however, unlike Donald Trump, a Republican loyalist, a good party person, a very effective member of the Senate, chairman of the Armed Services Committee for many years. So very different kind of person. He was bringing these ideas into the party but not trying to undermine the party. McGovern, same kind of profile. You had a divided Democratic Party. You had people feeling that the Humphrey wing, the moderates, were not listening to the anti-war wing, which was looked a lot like the Sanders people today. Again, kind of a similar sort of thing. McGovern headed a commission in the late 1960s that rewrote the rules of the nominating process to make them more open. And then, having rewritten the rules, he used those rules to get nominated as an insurgent. And he, too, lost spectacularly. So the same sorts of things went on. But once again, two things are important here. One, McGovern was a Democrat in longstanding, estimable man within his party, very estimable as a senator. And second, through both of these things, the country was able to govern and function right through both of these disruptions. They were able to absorb all of these outside forces, metabolize them, digest them, and keep moving. And that's how it works when it's healthy.
Thanks, Jerry, for your call. Jimmy in Boulder Junction. Hi.
Afternoon.
Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, I heard the guest, talk about that we're beating up the political professionals and the long-standing political operatives in the system. And I get that somewhat. I think it's overboard. I think, they attack so they can make their own political points. But there is some validity when these politicians get in office, and it appears the only thing they're interested in is staying in office. Like, they come up with voter ID laws and gerrymandering congressional districts. And that's really got nothing to do with the business of running the government. That's got to do with them staying in power. And so if they would tend a little bit more to the people's business, especially the stuff that has to get done every year, like appropriations and those types of issues, and, you know, lay off the trying to rig the system so they can stay in for 20 or 30 years, I think that would go a long way to help the voters say, you know, maybe they aren't such a bad group. And I will take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Jimmy, for the call.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. That's an important point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm kind of unconventional on this one, but the whole point of getting elected and having power, if you're a political faction or party, is to keep power. You can't do much if you're out of office. So that's the business that politicians are in. And the way we deal with that is through contested elections. I'm worried about gerrymandering and some of those other things too. But if you want the hard stuff to get done on Capitol Hill, you're going to have to allow these guys to set up these systems so that they can be there from year to year and that they can basically be accountable for the long-term consequences of what they're doing. So stuff like, you know, term limits and favoring amateurs over professionals and wanting every primary and every general election to be maximally contested. Those things tend to be counterproductive because you've got to give these guys a margin of safety. Politicians have known for decades, since the time of Martin Van Buren, our first great machine politician, that in order to govern, it's not enough to just have good intentions. You need some structural support. You need a political machine that'll back you up so that when you have to do some difficult things in politics, which you do all the time, make hard compromises, make people unhappy, make difficult choices, you're not going to get thrown out of office the very next day.
Thanks very much, Jimmy, for your call. Before we go back to phone calls, I want to talk a little bit about, you brought up so many different issues here, but this term that you have used, politophobes, a huge number of Americans they have a distorted view of how the government is supposed to work, how politics are supposed to work. Amplify that description of politophobes, please.
So back in the early 2000s, a couple of political scientists, John Hibbing and Elizabeth Tice Morse, wrote an amazing book called Stealth Democracy. They did a whole bunch of polling and a bunch of focus groups and determined that anywhere between 25 to 40% of Americans, depending, you know, what kind of measures you use, believe that the whole idea of contested politics is wrong. The way they think it should work is that there are just obvious solutions to our problems out there waiting to get adopted. And it should be kind of like running a business. You know, you should just elect good people or what they call empathetic, non-self-interested decision makers, NSIDs. And then these good people, once elected, go up there to Washington, vote to do the right thing, the problem is solved, and you're done. Now, it turns out these people don't really care if the NSIDs are elected politicians or technocrats or, for that matter, authoritarians. They're not actually big fans of democracy, as I understand it, which is a negotiation, a give and take, a system of messy compromise, you know, where people disagree all the time. They're kind of against all that. They just want someone to come along and, like, fix it. So people didn't pay a whole lot of attention to that work at the time, but they sure are now because it's very consistent with what we see with both Trump and Sanders, these outsiders who, in my opinion, don't have practical ideas for actual governing, but who come along and say, well, elect me. I'll magically fix it. It's going to be wonderful. I'll do the right thing.
Let's go next to Abraham. Hi, Abraham.
Well, Kathleen, and hello to the guest. There's so much here that I disagree with the guest I would like to point out. I'll try to be as succinct as I can. I'll first start with the idea that we should run our country from behind closed doors more so than we already do. We have the oldest and one of the first, if not the first, democracies in the world. It is true that our constitution was written behind the closed door. The processes that initially built our government took place behind closed doors. But we were lucky enough that those people that were, building our government, many of which we like to call our the fathers of our nation, were, intelligent enough to realize that maybe power should be given to the people rather than to an individual or a group of people. Now, to go back and squander that and say, you know what, they did it behind closed doors, then we should do it behind closed doors, I think is really just the wrong thing to do.
All right, let's get a response. Jonathan.
So no one's saying, pardon me, got a frog in my throat. No one's saying that everything should be done behind closed doors. That would be silly. Pardon me.
That's okay. You okay? You want some water?
Yeah, I'm sipping away here.
Good. All right.
My frog seems to have jumped out of my throat. So this is a question of better balance. So much now is so exposed to public view that it is a challenge for a committee to meet, for example, behind closed doors and take a straw vote to figure out where everyone is and figure out how the deals are done. They're going to have to meet usually in much smaller groups, in more informal settings, and makes it harder to get the stuff done. We used to have a practice until very recently, right through the 70s, where a lot of times congressional committees and subcommittees would hold votes without recording how each particular member voted. So what you get would be a committee tally. And no one was outraged about that. No one said, that's ridiculous and abusive, because what it allowed the committee to do was kind of speak with one voice, gave them some insulation. So I'm not saying that everything should be behind closed doors, but I'm with Madison. I think that where you have delicate negotiations that are complicated and where nothing is settled until everything is settled, yeah, you need to give these guys out of the television cameras and out of the public view so that they won't be hammered. The first time someone says, well, how would this work? Within seconds now, someone's tweeting that and they're hammered by some interest group. We need to give them, a little bit more privacy to work in. Mm-hmm.
Well, you also mentioned social media. How has that changed politics in this country?
Social media is one of a long series of media disruptions, like the penny press and the 18th and 19th centuries that have come into politics. And it's kind of like what I said before. The disruptions will always happen, and that's in many ways a good thing. But they make it even more important that you have organized political structures and people in place who can react to those disruptions. Right now, it is very hard, especially for the Republican Party, to focus and frame a message of any kind at any level, because it's whatever anybody wants to say. There's so little effective organization, and the establishment has been so weakened that it's pretty much chaos all over the place, with the message being whatever any particular candidate or interest group or outside group that's dumping ads on the air wants to say. So once again, this is... See, what I call chaos syndrome, Kathleen, it's kind of like chronic fatigue syndrome. It makes everything else harder to do because it makes it harder to organize to do anything.
Thanks so much for your call, Ibrahim. We go to Todd in Appleton. Hello, Todd.
Hi.
Hi.
And to the guest, I am 71 years old, and so I graduated in 1963 in Nina. And I remember, and I will never forget, a debate that was conducted in the auditorium for the whole student body between Senator Proxmeyer and then Senator Wiley. And the purpose of the debate, which covered a lot of different issues, from nuclear arms control back in the Cold War to civil rights to a lot of other things, and it was to teach us civil debate. And I don't think either one of them totally agreed with each other at the end of it. It was about an hour and a half long, but it was an introduction, at least an eye-opening introduction to me, to the political process as the guest mentioned before, about, you know, the need for that kind of civil debate. Mm-hmm. And I think my concern is that I'm not so sure how much of that is presented in our education system so that the average citizen in their 20s and 30s actually understands how it's supposed to work, and thus the anger that we have and frustration.
That's an interesting
Well, I think, reflection. Todd, yeah, you're on to something, Todd. You know, when Justice Sandra Day O'Connor left the Supreme Court, the first thing she decided to devote herself to is getting civics education reintroduced into the schools, because we let go of that in order to do standards of learning tests and, you know, math and science and everything. And that turns out to have been a mistake, because as I talk about this issue on radio and elsewhere, I am genuinely surprised by the number of people who think compromise is a bad thing. We shouldn't even do it because it means you're doing the wrong thing instead of the right thing. They don't seem to realize that the whole system is based on the idea of making people compromise or getting them to compromise in a system where people just naturally disagree. So, yeah, I've really come around to thinking that we do need to reintroduce some of those basic civics back into the schools.
And it goes back to what you said in the piece, that between 25% and 40% of Americans have a severely distorted view of how government and politics are supposed to work. Does it mean they don't have any view, or what view do they have?
Well, a whole lot of them take the view that Ross Perot spoke to in 1996, 1992, where he just said, you know, pardon me, elect a businessman and I'll just fix it. I'll go in there and get it fixed. And Trump and Sanders, especially Trump, appeal to the exact same fantasy. You know, it's going to be huge. It's going to be great. Just elect me and I'll fix it. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who take the view that if you just, you know, get rid of the old people who are the problem and put in someone new, you're going to fix it. Well, no. Politics is a team sport, and you've got to have team players.
More phone calls in just a moment. Our guest this hour, Jonathan Rauch. He wrote the Atlantic's July-August 2016 cover story, How American Politics Went Insane. And we are welcoming phone calls for him. Todd, thanks for your reminiscence. Our number is 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go next to Claire in Madison. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you.
Sure, Claire.
your guest, I respectfully 100% disagree with, although he will probably think I'm a kook. Here's my problem with his theory. He presumes that the two parties that we have right now are the perfect system. And I couldn't disagree with that more, sir. I would respectfully ask, have you ever been to a Bernie Sanders rally? Because Bernie Sanders is the complete opposite of a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz. He has said repeatedly, this is not about him. This is about fixing a system that's broken, that does not represent the people unless you are extremely wealthy and have all kinds of money to throw politicians' way. But the other thing about Bernie is he offers solutions. He is not at all like Donald Trump. And people aren't getting represented. And the two-party system is so broken. It needs to start over.
All right, Claire. Thanks for your call, Jonathan.
Well, yeah, that's a view. It's pretty much different from my view. When I look at Senator Sanders, I don't see practical plans for governing that could actually be put into effect. I don't see a way to pay for the stuff he talks about. I don't see a way to pass it through a Republican Congress. I see the advertisement or promise of a revolution, which he couldn't possibly deliver. I think what he's doing that's good and healthy is bringing in fresh ideas to the party and getting some ideas and some people spoken for who don't get heard from. So that's all good. And I certainly welcome that. But it's important to have a system that can do things, not just say things. And the trouble with a system that favors completely self-propelled independent candidates who don't have to worry about the health of the party in the long term, may not even be members of the party, is it's very hard for those people to work with others. And that's why you get the second grade soccer problem. So, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with Senator Sanders or his supporters. In fact, just the opposite of that. But I'm saying let's have a system that can, pardon me,
sure,
can adapt to that.
I'm wondering if you look at the number of people, Jonathan, who consider themselves, who identify as Democratic or Republican, that that number keeps going down. More and more Americans are considering themselves to be independent. Why is that? Did the chaos create that, or do you have to have a whole lot more Americans join parties in order for the parties to be strong once again?
Well, it's both. I'm sorry, my throat is...
Oh.
Giving out. I don't know why.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have a cough drop with you?
I'm afraid I don't, so.
Oh, maybe somebody can get one for you.
Never happened before, but let me see if I can answer the question.
Okay.
Feels like just a bit of a burr in the throat or something.
Mm.
So when parties lose their centrality in the process, it doesn't really matter if you join one anymore. These days, a party, especially on the Republican side, a party is just a brand, right? Like, you don't get anything from being a Democrat or a Republican. And anyone can vote in many primaries now. You don't have to be a member of either party. So it's not surprising that people would leave the parties if they don't feel parties are doing anything. And what one of the earlier callers said is absolutely true. The parties have drifted off-center. So there's less of a place that's representative for moderates as opposed to people on the extremes. And that's also tending to push people out of parties. So what we have to do is sort of reverse this syndrome, re-empower parties to make them more meaningful, and help them do what they've traditionally been doing well, which is bring in a whole bunch of voices into a coalition. That's how we do it when it works in America. And you know, the answer to the third or fourth party question is, well, we don't really have that kind of system, so let's fix this one.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Jonathan Rauch is our guest. His piece is the cover story of The Atlantic for July, August, How American Politics Went Insane. And let's go next to Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Howdy.
Hi.
Excuse me, I'm blocking on the word gerrymandering. Excuse me. What is your opinion of gerrymandering here in Wisconsin? I guess in September they're going to take a case to federal court that's supposed to end up in the Supreme Court. And the gerrymandering has been atrocious here in Wisconsin, and they haven't had any problem whatsoever getting the Republicans to stand in line to back up the Republican Party's position.
Jonathan.
Yeah, gerrymandering is as old as the Republic. It goes back to Eldridge Gerry back in the, I think, 1820s or 30s. It's out of hand, and it's had some strange side effects. It turns out now that so many members of the House, because that's in the federal level, that's where it takes place, not the Senate, so many members of the House are in safe general election districts that the only thing they're worried about is getting challenged in a primary. So the real election is the party primary. But there, it turns out, the people who are most likely to turn out to vote are the extremists and the special interest groups. So you get candidates who get further and further from the center, and the center starts to hollow out. So, yeah, there are a lot of states and places that are experimenting with commissions and other systems that are trying to deal with this. And all of that is well worth watching. On the other hand, it's not a magic bullet. It's just one small part of a big puzzle because, you know, we see the same tendencies toward polarization and dysfunction in the Senate. And the Senate's not gerrymandered at all.
Thank you so much, Carl, for your call. Mike is next in Racine. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Mike.
Jonathan, regarding the Supreme Court nomination process, where the president nominates and then Congress gets a chance to review it, it seems to me like the founding fathers missed some verbiage there, or maybe the interpretation. Does the president need explicit vote and approval, or is it just with here's who I wish to appoint, and if they don't give their explicit approval, he can appoint it regardless. It seems to me there's some language that's missing, that there should have been a timeline, because I don't see anything where this Congress couldn't, in effect, stonewall for the next 4.5 years until the next election.
Well, they could, actually. I've been worried about for a number of years now, if a swing seat opened on the Supreme Court, would it even be possible to fill it? Because one side might just say, sorry, we are never, ever going to vote to tip the Supreme Court. So that is a real possibility. It's a political problem, though, not a constitutional problem. I don't think you could fix it by changing the words on paper, nor are we going to amend the Constitution anytime soon to, you know, require a vote. So it's going to be up to the voters to hold folks accountable. And if they don't like what the Republicans are doing with President Obama's nomination of Judge Garland, well, you know, they would need to vote accordingly and show the Republicans that.
I believe you do your 2020 scenario with 3 vacancies. They haven't been filled because there haven't been votes on them, right?
Yeah, basically. Can't get anyone through because anyone you put on there is going to tip the court the wrong way from someone's point of view.
So if you could get together, you know, let's just do a time machine for a while and go back to those founders in 1787 and sit down with them and say, hey, listen, you forgot this and we got these problems in 2016 because you just didn't figure this out as fully as you should. What would you ask them to pay attention to?
Well, Kathleen, that's, boy, what would I tell James Madison
yes.
that would make me smarter than him?
I know you love him, but what would you tell him?
I would say to take a good hard look at the British parliamentary system, which came along after ours. Remember, our guys went first, so they didn't have anything to look at. A parliamentary system gives parties power by definition, because you run as a member of your party. The party appoints you to the job, and then the voters elect the party and not the person. So that wires in some accountability and some team play right into the basic system. So I would have said, you know, we should take a harder look at this idea that every politician should be independently elected, because that's like herding cats or second-grade soccer.
One more phone call. We only have a minute left. Anne in Milwaukee. Hi. Has to be quick.
Hi. I wanted to know what your follow-up question as an investigative reporter would have been to Loretta Lynch's statement that they were primarily, in quotes, discussing grandchildren and golf on the plane. And I'm talking about with Bill.
All right. Slightly off topic, but do you have a comment on that, Jonathan?
I'd take her word for it. I think that she's an honest law enforcement officer, and they don't talk about ongoing investigations. And until someone explains to me why she would contaminate her ongoing investigation and put it all at risk, I'm going to say I have no reason to assume that she did.
Thank you very much for the call. Thank you, Jonathan, for being with us.
Thank you. I'm sorry about my short bout of pneumonia there.
You know what? I think maybe you have some allergy stuff going on because I'm diagnosing it, but I've got it too. And a lot of people I know have the same thing. So there's something, you know, it gets in the sinuses, it gets in your throat. You'll be fine. You just got to drink water. And
only happens on the radio, though, when it really matters.
I know. It's all right. You were great.
Or in the concert hall.
Right. Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Rauch, his piece is the cover story of the July-August issue of the Atlantic, and it's how American politics went insane. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing the hour, and thanks to Kiri Salinas for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to KP Whaley as well, and for all of your calls. It's one of those interesting hours because he'll say some things you think, oh, yeah, I agree with that, and others, he makes you think, right? Which is what we're all about, thinking. News is coming up momentarily. Daniel Golden will join us. Get your papers and pencils out. We're going to talk about summer reading.